Well, good morning, everybody. Good to be down here in the warm climes of southern Minnesota. Actually, just got back from North Carolina. Flew in. We left the airport, Minneapolis. That morning, I think it was around 10 below, somewhere like that. Dropped into Raleigh, where my son lives, and it was 70. And we actually had turned on the air conditioning. My son turned on the air conditioning in his house for a while. It was warm. Then dropped down to 50, and that still was pretty nice. But I think the last day, help me out, fellas, in Charlotte, we went down to see granddaughters going to school. So we kind of had a double dip. It was probably high of, about 30, 28, something like that, which is pretty cold for them. But anyway, it's good to be here. And what entertainment. We have about a 25% chance of catching the Family Von Jacobson entertainers when we come up here. And we saw the first father-son duo, and then the second, I don't think I've ever seen James play before. Now, I think it's Jonathan plays, is it the violin or the cello? Plays both. Okay. What a talented family. I play the radio, would you like? Not very well, though. Well, I got a couple of extra minutes here, and I can't recall whether last time I got into the concept of the catalyst, the prophetic catalyst. Did I talk about the prophetic catalyst here last time? I'm just going to mention a couple of things because of, kind of a sad note. Jezri Charlie, which is all over the news. Everybody knows about that, right? Charlie Hebdo, the satirical magazine from Paris. And when I say catalysts, what I'm talking about is we look at the four main players at the end time. Three of them have to be catalyzed to develop and grow, and one is catalyzed the other direction. And, of course, the one that's going down for the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years has been modern Israel. And we see it all around us. And, of course, the pride of our power is literally being eroded day by day. I mean, it's incredible. It seems like every day goes by, there's something in the last, 6 years certainly. And we've seen it ebb and flow since World War I. We'd come back up, or World War II. It would come back up if we'd have a little blip, under Ronald Reagan and maybe, Desert Storm, a little bit back. But, I mean, we certainly are in a low ebb. So we've seen modern Israel certainly erode as far as its power base and as far as its standing in the world and respect. The other three big players on the end time stage, of course, are the hordes of the East, King of the North, and the King of the South. Well, we've watched a gentleman, and I've got a very interesting book called The Colder War. And it's about Vladimir Putin. What a very interesting individual. Here's a man who is playing chess, like Russians do very well, while the West is playing checkers. And he's got a setup, and this book goes in. And now they hit a little hard time here with the oil, but they'll be back. And the Chinese, we know, of course, have just right there, nip and tuck with the United States as far as the world's largest economy, single nation. The euro, of course, is a little bigger, the eurozone. So they're on the rise. That leaves the King of the North and King of the South. Well, the catalyst that got the King of the South going was probably the Arab Spring and the Arab Summer and the Arab Fall, which have kind of progressively brought them online and kind of, I would say, galvanized around ISIS, which has brought out the word that we see really reflected in the Bible. We call the caliphate. And the caliphate is this religious empire that started with Muhammad, came back up mightily during Suleiman the Great in the 1100s, and then later on under the Ottoman Empire. And it was taken down after World War I by the British and the Allies. But it is now on the rise again, and I don't think there's any doubt about it. And what we're seeing in Europe, I didn't realize there are like 55 million Muslims in Europe right now. And in Paris, the actual city, it's about 8-9 million people. It's one of the largest cities in the world. Has like 53 or 4, I'm not sure I get that number right, what they call no-go zones. And they were talking about it, how they've totally lost control, where they practice Sharia law. And so you ask yourself the question, we see everything else is catalyzed up or down. Of course, we know the king of the south has to rise. We know the hordes of the east have to rise. We know Israel has to go down. But what is going to catalyze sleepy, moribund, and feckless Europe? The Eurozone, European Union. Because there's no leadership there. Right now, in my mind, there are two strong leaders in the world, and we can disagree about that, but right now, the only two I know of are Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel, strong leader from day one, calls him as he sees him, bright as a bulb, and then this new prime minister from Australia by the name of Tony Abbott. And he's starting to talk and speak about things that need to be spoken of. And in a strong way. So the question is, what's going to happen in Europe? There are no strong leaders. I mean, even now, Hollande, I don't know if I'm pronouncing exactly right. It looks like Holland, but it's Hollande. Anyway, he, like our president, unfortunately, it's a time of weakness. And so you ask the question, what is it going to take to catalyze what we know to be the beast power, the king of the north, which will become the strongest, in this case, confederation, a United States of Europe, strongest confederation in the history of mankind? It says the whole world will worship up. Who would make war with the beast? What's going to catalyze that? From the current situation, well, I don't know if I'm pronouncing right, any French speakers there, Charlie may have been it. The anger that is brewing over there, and there are a lot of pockets, enclaves of right wing, we would call them this country militarists, white supremacists, they have a lot of them over there. And they have been rattling, if not sabers, they have been rattling their pens. There is talk going around. There are newspapers. There are leaders here. A gentleman from Holland is very strong. His name is Wilders. I forget his last name. And there's a gentleman from Austria. There's a strong Austrian party. So the neo-Nazis and those of their ilk are rumbling in the background. And they're waiting for something because of all the weakness. So I think, you know, it's something like this. You look for a catalyst. The Arab Spring started to catalyze as they kicked out all the secular leaders. Because you couldn't have a caliphate with secular leaders. Like, you know, Muammar or Muammar Gaddafi and the one in Egypt, ghastly. How can I forget that? Hosni Mubarak, and of course, Anwar Sadat. So, anyway, what a time! Not much going on, right? We've been waiting for this time, trying to understand from biblical prophecy what is going to take place to catalyze it, to get these things going. It could very well be that Jésus Charlie might be the tinder, might be the flame that ignites the tinder, that starts to draw Europe together and create the strength that they need to step on that prophetic stage. So, a lot to keep track of, a lot to watch. So, I thought I'd just mention a few of those things because I'd kind of done that in some of the other areas. But, of course, it's very late breaking and just this last Wednesday. So, anyway, can't go into the sermon on a downer, but just want to take a couple minutes, kind of bring you up to speed, and many are probably thinking about those things already. We're down North Carolina, visit two granddaughters. One is 2.5, going on 15. She's a fireball, one of these Energizer buddies, just all over the place, very coordinated, climbs on everything. She doesn't fall too much. She's pretty adept. But she's a hoot, like most grandkids. You know, my wife Phyllis has a little cushion that says, we know how much fun grandkids were, we'd had them first. You probably heard that before. So anyway, this is a little story about a granddaughter. A grandmother overheard her 5-year-old granddaughter playing wedding. The wedding vows went like this. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say might be held against you. You have the right to have an attorney present. Now you may kiss the bride. She obviously had heard a few things and put them together into her own. So anyway, we had fun with the granddaughters. We got one in college down there in Charlotte and had a chance to visit with her. She wasn't talking wedding vows, though, which she does have a boyfriend church, though. Okay. Do we have a sermon here somewhere? Take requests. There's a deadly creature that stalks the earth, and it lurks among us. It's a monster that has large green eyes, and it is worse than great anger and vengeful wrath. It strikes like a cancer, and yes, it can kill. It is maybe one of the worst and most deadly of all cancer, spiritual cancers, and character flaws. What is this monster with eyes of green? Well, you may have an idea. Let's see. Turn over to Proverbs 27. Going the same place Mr. Spain went. Enjoyed that sermonette, by the way. Very interesting. 27 verse 4. It says, and I'll be reading from the New International Version, anger is cruel and fury overwhelming, but who can stand before jealousy, or as the King James, and I like this better, envy? Because I think envy captures more accurately in most people's mind, because we often think about God saying in the Bible, he is jealous for his people. It's not a negative emotion when he does it that way. Whereas envy has no positive aspects or denotations or connotations. The monster more dangerous than anger and wrath, like I said, is the four-letter emotion envy. Why? Why is this? It's a negative emotion, granted, one of the many. Why is it, though, so dangerous? As a great teacher tells us. Well, it's a story worth telling. For within its understanding, and that's what we're going to do. We're going to try to understand today the depths and the range of envy and what it can do to an individual and by extension to an entire society and a world, as we'll see. To begin our search, let's see where the metaphor gem, green-eyed monster, came from. It appears to have originated from the pen of a man who is said could write a little. The great English bard, William Shakespeare. I'd just like to quote from him. It's from an article called The Green-Eyed Monster, and it quotes Shakespeare from two sources. One, this is from Portia, the Merchant of Venice. She wrote in 1596. And he says, how all the other passions fleet to air as doubtful thoughts and rash embrace despair and shuddering fear and green-eyed jealousy. So it's possible that's where it originated. He also says later on, 8 years later when he did Othello, I said, quoting from through the mouth of Iago, "Oh, beware, my lord, of jealousy. It is the green-eyed monster which doth mock." The green-eyed monster which doth mock. Mock who? Well, we'll see a little bit later. So Mr. Shakespeare, a most astute observer, and we find for those that have ever read anything and recorder of human nature, maybe ever. He's one of the great ones. He maybe was even better than, well, we don't take a lot of stock in Freud and the company, but Shakespeare had a keen ability, and you see that in his writings, to see inside the human heart and mind and then portray them on the stage, reflecting the stage of life, literally. So he was great, and he noted the great power of envy or jealousy, including its not-so-subtle ability to mock. Very interesting set of observations. Let's go back to its naked beginnings. Let's turn over to Isaiah 14. Isaiah 14, verses 12 through 14. Pick up the story here about a being that we know transitions, transmogrifies, to use Calvin and Hobbes, in this from a physical human being to one of the other world. Verse 12. "How you have fallen from heaven, O morning star, son of the dawn. You have been cast down to the earth, you who once laid low the nations. You said in your heart, I will ascend to the heaven." Excuse me, I'm probably getting away from here. Lose you here. Got to be careful about that. I'm used to having a lapel mic. "You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. And I will sit enthroned on the Mount of Assembly, on the utmost heights of the sacred mountain. And I will ascend above the tops of the clouds. And I will make myself like the Most High." Why? Why did Satan want a different position? He was obviously aspiring to something far greater, as we can tell. Well, let's dig a little deeper. Go over to Ezekiel, two classic chapters that kind of get in the head and heart and makeup of the being that became known as Satan, the devil. Chapter 28. We'll pick up the thread here in a little more detail. 28, verse 12. Once again, a transmogrification. "The Son of Man take up a lament concerning the king of Tyre and say to him, this is what the sovereign Lord says. You were the model of perfection, full of wisdom, perfect in beauty." Not a bad initial resume. How would you like your resume to read like verse 12? I wouldn't mind mine saying, beautiful, wise, model of perfection. Now, fit anything else you want in there. Then you get better than that, does it? Let's continue the thought. Verse 13. "You were in Eden," and of course this is where the transmogrification, I suppose a human being can almost be perfect in beauty if you're looking at one of the great Italian sculptures or something. We created Michelangelo, created David, or one of those great statues, you can say, all right, you could create something close to perfection. But it says, you were in Eden, the garden of God, and every precious stone adorned you. So immediately we transition into a being that obviously was not the king of Tyre. And it goes on to describe that beauty and how God created and how he made him up. And of course, it might be an acquired beauty. I guess in my mind, it's hard to think of a serpent or think of a dragon or whatever as being beautiful, but I suppose it could be, and we'll have that opportunity, I'm sure, as we go through at the wedding supper, and, you know, there'll be a big screen come down, and God goes through, you know, at the wedding supper, I'm sure, is after dinner, not only a form of entertainment, but also training, and we'll get to see all this. So anyway, the description is here in great detail. He paints the picture in more detail. Then we go on in verse 14. It says, here we get into his career path. You were anointed as a guardian cherub. So I ordained you, and you were on the holy mount of God, and you walked among the fiery stones. Anointed covering cherub at the very throne of God. I don't know where that ranked in position, but assuming you had the Father and the Word, the three archangels, you probably were at least 3A, B, or C. You know, right there at the top. Now, I don't know how the 24 elders fit in, but it's right up there anyway. To me, I read this, and it sounds like a pretty good gig. Matter of fact, seeing the Father and Christ are eternal, back ever as well as forever, never been created, and of course the angels must have known once they woke up in heaven, the third heaven, and God explained to them what they were and what their jobs were and the power they had and responsibilities. Okay, we're created. So, amongst created beings, he was right there, right at the top. So pretty good gig. But that wasn't enough. We see here him going on to maybe wanting to be something far greater. Maybe number two. Or no, who knows? Maybe 1B or even perish the thought. Numero uno. My, how far can the twin character killers of pride and envy take one? Pride opens the door, and envy drives you through. We'll see more about this. We'll go. Verse 17. Your heart became proud on account of your beauty, and you corrupted your wisdom because of your splendor. So I threw you to the earth and made a spectacle of you before the kings. I don't know about you, I've read this part of the Bible dozens and dozens of times. And maybe even 100, I don't know. And you have to shake your head at what these two can do to a being. One that had all that Satan had going for him, for Lucifer at that time, the morning star. We know that pride is all about self. It's unreasonable, aggrandized version. But envy is a comparative discontent that moves you, according to Mr. Webster, that is aroused at the sight of another's excellence or success. It's a comparative or comparison problem that ironically seems to dwell, you know, you think about it, who are the ones most often, you even see this in the Bible, that have this problem? Oftentimes, it's in the heart of those with the most, who have the most. And here we have the first example. He had everything. He was at the top, totally at the top of his game. And of course, we know how God feels about comparisons. Over in 2 Corinthians 10:12, you just jot that down. He tells us how unwise it is to get into the comparison game, which leads to, because that's how, is it not, that envy is aroused. You start comparing to somebody else. Now, if you're living out on an island someplace in the South Pacific all by yourself, and you had, you know, a dog Friday, or maybe a chimp or somebody for companionship, you probably wouldn't get into the problem in the same way. Now, maybe it could arise over other situations, but basically it's a comparison problem. And what God tells us is it's very unwise, because every human being, like snowflakes, are absolutely unique, even identical twins. They may have similarities, but it's like comparing spiritual oranges and apples. It's unwise. It's a futile exercise. So here we see Satan with absolutely everything, and it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough. Like I said, we can tour the Old Testament, and even the greatest struggled with the gem, the green-eyed monster. Jacob, David, Solomon, Cain, maybe the first, with the gem disease. Yeah, it's a great irony. Today's studies have been done by anthropologists and sociologists. They look the world over, they go into societies, and they'll study them and try to understand why they work the way they do, get into their culture. I had a little cultural anthropology when I was in college. It's very interesting. And what they found interesting, quite counterintuitive, ironic, was often the poorest peoples on the planet were the most satisfied. In fact, the pygmies of Central Africa are considered among the poorest, if not the poorest. Very subsistent, might say hard scrabble existence. They don't have any technology to speak of. Came out top in the studies. Poor in material goods, but obviously rich in spiritual or emotional goods, as the Bible looks. Kind of a fulfillment of Romans 2:14, where it talks about those that do not have the law, but who do the law by nature, have the law, you know, in a sense, written in their hearts. And it's kind of ironic. It doesn't appear that there's a lot of that green-eyed monster lurking in the villages of the pygmies. So it is kind of strange twist of counterintuitive irony that the more you have, the more you want and desire. And if somebody else has got it, that triggers it and makes it even worse. Kind of the way it works. It's kind of strange in some respects. Your mind and your heart, your emotions kind of go to war over that. You say, that doesn't make sense, and yet the feelings are there. Yeah, all I have to do is look at society today. What is the mantra that has come out? The gem monster mantra that's come out in the last few years. He who dies with the most toys wins. He who's got the most, the biggest house, the fastest car, the most cars, you know, most of this, most of that. So obviously, the pygmies with their very small needs didn't get the message, right? Now, the ultimate psychology textbook is the Bible, obviously. The maker of any product is going to know his product better than anybody else. Anybody just observes from the outside. And in this case, I don't think we'd have any problem realizing that. So Freud and company down through the ages, as they've observed human psychology and conduct, came to understand certain things. You know, they're not totally without knowledge, but the old proof is in the pudding, and they haven't been all that successful. Matter of fact, These observers, the users of the couch, sorry, Bob Newhart. I like Bob Newhart, but for those who've watched him, but they really don't know very much about how we tick. And the reason I know that is some 90+% I think it's closer to 95%, maybe even higher, of those individuals that go on the couch with either a psychiatrist, psychologist, some sort of a counselor, don't get better. They don't improve psychologically. That's statistically. I didn't come up with that. It doesn't work. And, of course, there are very good reasons for that, because they got the wrong textbook. And this textbook isn't very popular these days in most of the world. The closest success that I've ever heard of was a psychiatrist who was captured during World War II. And he spent a good share of the war in Nazi prison camps. And one of the things he was able to do was help people get through that almost Jobian experience. And he was able to help quite a few survive. Not those destined, certainly, for the gas chamber, but many others. So a lot of them would happen, would give up and die, and they ended up there anyway. But what he found was he was able to help those who were willing to do certain things. Recognize, and he would bring this was from his studies, he would show them that life had meaning, and even in the worst state, and that we all must take personal responsibility for who we are and what we do. And I would say that's just about the bottom line with the problem of society today. Nobody wants to take responsibility anymore. Everything is victimhood, victimization. Pretty amazing insight from somebody from the world, and I don't think he was converted. He was Jewish. He lived in a world that back then was more religious, certainly in some respects, than it is today. I think we could assume that, but most people today don't think there's a lot of purpose to life. And they like to blame everybody else, like I said. But he was able to help a lot of individuals get through that. That kind of sounds familiar, doesn't it? Because, you know, when it comes to spiritual life and spiritual existence, those are the exact things that God demands of us, is it not? He paints the picture, and interestingly, Frankl understood, he said, the purpose of life was love. And of course, that's exactly, you know, the central theme of the Bible. Matthew 5:48, become you therefore perfect, spiritually mature, like your Father is in heaven. And what is God? Love. So Frankl understood certainly enough of that, and maybe his Jewish background or whatever, he maybe, had studied quite a bit, and maybe even was a believer. I don't know. I know this today. You go to Israel, 90% of them are atheists because of the Holocaust. Only 10%, the Hasidim, the Orthodox Jews, are the ones that are carrying the flame for the Jewish religion. They have a strong flame. They want to rebuild the third temple. They think these four blood moons are the signal from Jonah to rebuild that third temple, which is pretty central. It's a lot of things that are going to happen. So that's sitting out there too, waiting. I think I mentioned that before. So anyway, it gets down that Frankl really had it nailed, that these things are really very, very scriptural. Are they not? And they're the first big step on the road to repentance and salvation. Getting out the old mirror. Taking a look at the real self, the Jeremiah 17:9, Romans 8:7, Isaiah 64:6, self. And take personal stock and responsibility. It's the beginning assault on the green-eyed monster. Taking him out. So let's look into the Ultimate Psychology textbook for a little bit to see what the Master of Masters of Psychology has to say about the green-eyed monster. The Hebrew word is kinah for envy, and it can be translated either envy or jealousy. There are subtle differences. Envy wants to take what you have, deprive you, whereas jealousy more leans to wanting to have or to be like somebody. You know, you're jealous of a movie star or some great athlete or, you know, some great business magnate or something. The Greek word in the New Testament is phthonos, P-H-T-H-O-N-O-S. And Vine's dictionary defines it, and the Greeks produced a language that was very exact. It was good. It was a good scientific language. It was more precise, whereas the Greeks were more emotional, and you see, the Jews were more emotional. And it's kind of interesting, too, when you compare the two, the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Greek to the Jew. The Jew wants a miracle, you know, which will affect his heart and move him emotionally. The Greek wants to reason with you. Remember, Paul went into the marketplace in Mars Hill and reasoned with the Greeks. The Jews said, we want to see a miracle. So it's interesting, the psychology there and the way the different cultures and, races were put together. So Greek, Vines goes on to define the Greek phthonos as a feeling of displeasure produced by witnessing or hearing of the advantage or the prosperity of others. This evil sense is always attached to envy. Envy always has that negative connotation, where, like I mentioned, jealousy has a positive side to it. It has a zeal. Like God says, I am jealous for my people. So that's why I want to stay with envy rather than jealousy. There's no confusion or crossover there. So where does this basic, so human emotional response lead, according to the master psychologist? Let's go back to Proverbs 27, pick up where we started. 27:4. Hear that Hebrew kinah. Says that it's worse. Kinah is worse than anger and wrath, which God says must be controlled. And we see throughout the Bible, God says, do not be angry, sin not, don't let the sun go down on your wrath. So there's a time, there's a righteous indignation, but wrath and those things need to be controlled. Let's go back with Solomon again, to the 14th chapter, as we dig deeper into this theme. Chapter 14, verse 30. It says, a heart at peace gives life to the body, but envy rots the bones. He uses a metaphor here. In other words, it's like the C word. Envy is like a cancer that gets in emotionally and can destroy literally you, not only emotionally and spiritually, but also physically. And we all know what can happen. There's a story about John D. Rockefeller, the wealthiest man on the planet, pretty much after he struck oil. But his health went to pot. And he went into a doctor, and the doctor told him, he said, you're going to die, Mr. Rockefeller, if you don't start giving away some of your wealth instead of hoarding it, instead of being so avaricious and greedy. So it can destroy you physically. Ulcers, those types of things, a lot of time come out of that. It'll eat you up inside. In Job chapter 2, or 5, verse 2, just jot it down, we find Eliphaz telling Job that envy kills the simple, the unwise. It's a pretty tough series of indictments on old Kanah, isn't it? on envy and cause cancer literally, almost. It can make you unwise, simple. It can do all kinds of things. And it can mess with your mind, screw up your mind. You can't think properly and reason rationally. And we've all heard stories about that, how that can happen, how envy can destroy our ability to function on a number of levels. James chapter 3, let's go to the New Testament. James has a very interesting session on this subject. Let's go to chapter 3, verse 13. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show it by his good life, by deeds done in humility that come from wisdom. But if you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition, here's that old 1-2 again, envy and pride in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from heaven, but is earthy, unspiritual, of the devil. For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you'll find disorder and every evil practice. Now, isn't that an interesting connection? It's not one that you normally would make. So as we look at this, we have to ask the question. We think back what we saw in Isaiah 14 and 28. We think about a being that had absolutely everything. And you come to the conclusion that envy is really about not enough. That God, the Father of the family of man, has given one or some of his other children. And we see that in the parable kind of reflected indirectly in the parable of the talents. It appears the guy with one. Maybe there was, there could have been envy there with the 2 and the 5. And I'm sure there must have been a 4 and a 3 in there somewhere too. He just gave an example of the different ability levels. It's interesting. So the father of the family of man, it appears, is given some more than others. We know that. So it kind of creates the feeling that life isn't fair. There isn't enough. I'm a poor one talent guy. This guy over here's got 2, 3, 4, 5, or 10 or whatever it happens to be. He's got everything. So God doesn't take care of me. He doesn't satisfy my needs or wants. There's a lot of that out there. And that can destroy you. As we're going to see here, it's going to destroy the world in not too many years. Almost. Obviously, such individuals haven't read Psalm 37, verse 25, where David said, I have never seen the righteous begging bread. God always provided. And of course, Matthew 6:33, the famous Sermon on the Mount, where he said, I'll provide. Seek me first. Get your priorities right in life. And I'll take care of everything that you need. And things that you don't even realize you need. And those are the tough ones sometimes. So let's see where it leads. It's very interesting. It's not to a place you'd expect. Like I mentioned in verse 16 at the end there, with envy and selfish ambition, there you will find disorder and every evil. Every evil practice. It's got big coattails, doesn't it? This envy. It's a deep well. Let's plumb her a little deeper. Over in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, scripture we don't read too often. I remember it well from college because I had to give an impromptu on it. Stood up in speech class and they give you something to speak on. I just happened to pull out this scripture. It was kind of interesting. So that's probably why I remember it. Chapter 14, verse 33, for God is not a God of disorder, but of peace. God is not the God of disorder. What did we just read? Envy produces disorder. Now, this may be in a different context. Where do we first meet God? He's the creator, right? It's the way he does things, the way he practices. You look at the universe, it runs like a fine-tuned watch. Matter of fact, the best clock on the planet is what? It's an atomic clock. And it's based on God's design in the sense that it uses the periodicity, the regular aspects of atoms and the way they function. It's the most precise clock there is. So God is very precise. He's a fabulous engineer, and we know that. Romans 1 is all about that. You look at the universe, the sky, you look at nature, and all that we've learned over the last 6,000 years about the way the universe works, the laws. It's incredible. It's kind of interesting whenever I see this, I always think of the Ten Commandments. Cecil B. DeMille's classic with Charlton Heston. And there's Joshua, old John Derrick, standing up as they're heading out for the promised land. And he's up on this statue leading out of Thebes, I think it is. And or at least it might be part of Goshen, but it's a city. It's a major city. And he's standing up there, and you've got potentially, and the estimates are, somewhere between 2 and 3 million people. Potentially the size of all of Minneapolis-St. Paul metro. And he's standing up there, and Cecil B. DeMille, as the narrator, says, and there's Joshua, turning chaos into order. You know, as they're marching out, so it always struck me. Kind of reminds me of a joke. We just had our 50th class reunion, and it's kind of fun. For those of you who've been to class reunions, up to the 40th, everything was fine. I recognized everybody. The 50th, I had to have some people tell me who they were. They had changed that much from the 40th to the 50th. I don't know if you had that experience, but it was kind of interesting. We laughed about it. It wasn't a big thing. But it reminds me, four classmates sitting at the reunion. You had a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer, and a politician. And they were discussing whose profession was the oldest. And the lawyer said, well, you remember that first litigation? Cain versus Abel? Yeah. The doctor says, I got you beat there. Charlie says that first operation nosed you out by quite a bit. Remember when they took that rib out of Adam and made Eve? Boy, was that a fine piece of work. The engineer says, hey, boys. He says, I got you both beat. You remember that great engineering feat when God made the earth out of all that chaos? And the old politician sits back there chuckling with a Cheshire cat grin. Cheshire. It's easy for you to say. Cheshire cat grin. Hey, boys, where do you think all that chaos came from? Boy, do we know about that. All right. A little diversion. Talking about chaos. Remember the name of Satan's system and its meaning at the end time? Bad old Babylon. And it's a system built and sustained on what? Chaos. It means confusion. Tower goes back to Babel. And all you have to do is look at the world today. It's amazing things function as well as they do. It's an economic system. What's the primary reason businesses aren't expanding and hiring over the last several years? Uncertainty. Chaos coming out of old Foggy Bottom. Washington disease. Maybe I used that term last time. It's modern Babylon. It's on diabolical steroids. I mean, it's incredible. For us to sit here and watch this great nation, it's a tough time. This is happening around us. Kind of reminds me of an old retired salesman from our company, Anderson Chemical. He retired many years ago. He used to say, now this isn't something that we practice as a company or even believe, but it was just his observation. He said, in confusion, Bruce, there is profit. And unfortunately, that's true. Now, we didn't play the game that way, but he recognized what he saw out there in the competition. So Satan's modern version, Confusion the Great, I guess we could call it. John calls it that. When there's chaos and confusion, people are disoriented and they're not happy. And that's where gem work leads. The green-eyed monster, envy. I've often been intrigued by the subtle and the deep wisdom of one of our great homespun philosophers. I remember Will Rogers. Yeah, some of you do. He said, don't get me wrong, I'm going to qualify this. I'm not picking on anybody. I'm going to pick on everybody here. He says, I don't belong to any organized party. He says, I'm a Democrat. If you remember him saying that. Like I say, I'm not just picking on Democrats or liberals today. Because Republicans have, conservatives have their own issues, problems. But I merely bring it up in this James 3:16 context of disorder linked to envy. And it's not a hard connection to make. So looking into the liberal mind for just a moment in this context, recalling it was such minds that produced socialism, communism, evolution, the death of God, the welfare state, with its redistribution of wealth, creed, and no personal responsibility. The state will take care of you. The state is your mother. You don't need God. Religion is the opiate of the people, Karl Marx said. Of course, on the right, they got a good track record. They produced Nazism, fascism, Auschwitz, Treblinka, and Dachau. And Mao Zedong and Stalin and on and on. Well, Stalin and Mao were lefties, but they operated like righties. So you might say they're both equal opportunity tyrants with despotic ideologies. And what did they produce? Horrific wars. World War II, I think 50 to 75 million people died. Frankly, most of them in Russia. And during time leading up to Stalin, of course, killed somewhere around 20 million alone in the Ukraine. Starved them. But it appears it's kind of interesting. Like I mentioned, I think Putin, I don't know if I mentioned this, he's a chess player while we're playing checkers. Maybe I mentioned that. Satan is a master chess player. He knows how to weaken a society, bring one down and set it up. And of course, we know that God created modern Israel for a very important purpose. And especially focusing on who? The United States and British Commonwealth. Modern Joseph. The modern metaphor is what? Joseph was the great grain bin of ancient Israel in the Mideast. When he was in Egypt, he saved a lot of countries during the Great Famine because of his business ability that God gave him. Modern Joseph's the same way. God granted modern Joseph tremendous ability and wealth, of course, so that it could be the modern spiritual grain bin. And of course, where does the gospel flow from? You could not base the gospel effort in any place but an Israelitish nation. And you can barely do it there. A lot of the northeastern countries of Europe where Israel is located, yeah, we have a tough time. So it's places primarily the United States, Canada, Australia, South Africa to a degree, and some of those, Britain. So Satan understands that he can weaken a country, he can weaken a nation, and eventually weaken the world, and set it up. And he has a prototype he's already done by going the liberal route first. And right now, Europe, of course, is a socialist, well, confederation. And we're being pushed that direction. And it weakens us. We see the weakness all around us. And he knows what that does because it creates vacuums, political, geopolitical, and economic vacuums all over the world. And just like after World War I, it sets the stage, like it did with the Weimar Republic and the Versailles reparations that so weakened Germany, that eventually it created a vacuum that the proto-beast, Adolf Hitler, stepped into. We are there. All the conditions are ripe. The liberalism that has taken over this planet has so weakened us that we are now ready for the second beast, or the real beast. And the catalyst of Jésus Charlie may be the one that ignites enough of those countries, and especially the Assyrian mind centered in Germany and Austria and throughout that area, to start to catalyze and become strong again, just like it did in the early 30s. So when God allows Satan to create the envy that comes through socialism and redistribution of wealth, it so weakens and creates disorder and chaos. And then we know that's what happens in these communist countries. That's why they fall. Like Margaret Thatcher says, the reason socialism doesn't work is because pretty soon you run out of other people's money. And when you do that, you have chaos. Let's notice an interesting connection between two neighboring commandments. Of the Big Ten. The tenth commandment, covetousness. Another way of saying envy, right? You covet something, you're envious. You want something. The one right next to it, number 9, is very interesting in its relationship. Note it is the signature trait of Satan. The being who did not have enough. Because he is known as what? The father of adultery? The father of theft? No, the father of lies. Why is that? Well, it's with this seminal tool, with the lie, the ninth commandment of evil. Because remember what it said in James 3:16, all, not only disorder, you put disorder first, because disorder is the petri dish, the social petri dish in which all the other things can ferment and grow. It's with this tool he builds his diabolical kingdom and system, Babylon the Great, Chaos Incorporated. Sounds a little bit like a James Bond protagonist, doesn't it? How does that work? Well, when we envy, we don't have something, what are we willing to do to get it? We're willing to lie. Doesn't it? Doesn't that follow? And I think I mentioned this before. It's an interview I'll never forget. And you forget, you see a lot of interviews on TV over the years. I saw this one about 6 months ago, maybe 8 months ago. They're interviewing Paul Ryan, former running mate of George Romney. He was a vice president. Very bright individual from Wisconsin, our neighbor. And He's kind of the boy next door. You look at him, he's got a little widow's peak, short haircut, very good family man, great reputation. Everybody thinks he's a great guy. He's honest from everything you can read and find about him. And they interviewed him. They asked him why he got into politics, and he had all the usual answers, thought he could make a difference, and et cetera. He's very bright. Like I said, the only guy capable of wrapping his mind around a $3 to $4 trillion budget and kind of sorted out. But then they asked him, what's the downside? Because, you know, it's a tough business. It's rough and tumble. Politics is a contact sport. It's not for everybody. And he looked into the camera and he said, the toughest thing, the most difficult thing in politics in Washington, D.C. is everybody lies. And he put his finger and pointed it in the camera and he said, and they lie right to your face. This guy that you'd like your sister to marry, the boy next door, who I believe is an honest man, came out and said that. That was a mouthful. Now, I didn't mean probably 100%, but he meant the vast majority. And what that tells me is the father of lies, who is about ready to pounce on society like he has never before, and God is going to allow him, has his grips, his claws, his talons, his serpent-like talons into the headquarters of the greatest nation in the history of mankind. The heart of Israel, modern Israel. And he's going to bring it down with this tool of the 9th and 10th commandments. I'm still blown away when I think about that. It affects me viscerally. All you have to think about is what's been paraded across the screen the last few years. MIT professor John Gruber standing before, well, they've got one YouTube, one camera session after another recorded video session of stating how they had to lie to the people to get Obamacare passed. And that the people were too stupid to understand it. And on and on and on. Every time he turned around, he was lying and talking about the lies that had to be perpetrated to run government. And every time he turned around, Congress, the president and his cabinet are getting Pinocchios. Pinocchio is the most popular character in Washington, D.C. because they're giving out so many for one lie after another, just like Paul Ryan said. I need a drink after that. And on it goes. The cesspool is expanding everywhere. So how does destroying the sacred ninth create disorder and chaos? Well, it's probably a blinding flash of the obvious and too obvious for need of explanation, but bear with me. What happens when people start lying to each other because they want something? Isn't that what it is? Redistribution of wealth. They want your money. They want to take it from you and give it to somebody else. Very unbiblical. That's why the left hates the Bible and hates God. There's a lot in there that flies in the face of what they believe in. It's because nobody trusts each other anymore. And when they don't have trust, they really don't know what's going on. And then whether you're in business, in your community, your home, and you're trying to plant or the nation, how do you do it? You can't trust the information. You can't believe that next month, next year, things are going to be the same. And so as a result, the money sits on the sidelines. There's chaos and confusion. Nobody knows what's going on. And we sit here and cite example after example. I mean, the Chinese fire drill or the Keystone Cops, that was the rollout of Obamacare. You know, the computers, and on it goes. It just, and you're in the business world, and I'm not saying Anderson Chemical's perfect, but we've done pretty well. We're 104th year, you know, paying our employees, keeping the doors open. We know what we have to do to keep business. Any of you that are in business or have your own businesses or been in business at any level, you know what that's like. And to watch this country being run like it's being run, it's just, it blows your mind. It is chaos and confusion. Tohu and bohu. And of course, this all leads to good old Judges 21:25, where everybody then does what's right in his own eyes. There is no standard of right and wrong anymore, or even principle in the business world, in politics and the governing aspects. In Paul Ryan's City of Prevarication on the Potomac, City of Lies. It's amazing. Nobody knows what's going on anymore. So, we're smothered with lies of envy. Proverbs 29. Proverbs 29. Verse 2. When the righteous thrive, the people rejoice. When the wicked rule, the people groan. Don't we all yearn for a simpler time, less chaotic, and hopefully not too far ahead? For women and men of principle, where have all the good men gone? I mean, you know, piece out of that old Kingston Trio song. It's interesting to note, too, how James set this all up. We popped into the middle of a chapter. But nothing God does is without context. Nothing he does is without great thought, forethought, and preparation of idea and principle. The first 12 verses of the chapter are all about what? The human tongue. Right before those verses we just read about. And he goes into the importance of the human tongue and its influence on human history. It's a small rudder, like he says, that can turn a big ship, small organ. And you think down through history how that is going to be used to set up everything we've discussed to this point. As we think back to the harangues of the early 30s, and how Hitler, at that point, was a democratic system. The Weimar Republic, it was a republic. And he worked his way up. But his ability to orate during a time when the country was on its knees economically and struggling, and the national character that was and is Assyria, that will not Germanic, that will not put up with chaos and confusion for long. Probably less tolerant than any other peoples on the planet were ripe for the oratory of the proto-beast. With his, the Third Reich will last 1,000 years. Tough to counter that. Fortunately, God gave Israel, a man by the name of the old bulldog, Winnie Churchill, who personally willed, and we know that God gave him a lot of help. It's a great movie out now. How many have seen The Imitation Game? Story of Alan Turing, how they cracked the Enigma code, and some of the things that decisions Churchill had to make after that. It's a great story. I've read the book. I haven't gone to the movie yet. I want to. But God obviously did a lot of things, helped them invent radar, protect their little island. But Churchill, the primary thing that held that little island together, when they were facing the Nazi juggernaut just across the channel, 26 miles, were his words. That same tongue we're talking about. How he willed a tired and crippled people with, "I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat." And rallying to him, "Let us therefore brace ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last 1,000 years, men will say this was their finest hour." I don't make them like that anymore. Abe Lincoln, pretty good at Gettysburg. Remember that? "That this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth." Let me substitute one word in there. That government of God and by God for the people shall not perish for eternity. Yeah, they don't make them like that anymore. What power, what eloquence, what feeling. So James knew the power of the tongue for both good and evil. And when flamed by the green-eyed monster, Lebensraum, you remember when Hitler talked about that? The tyrant from Austria said, "The German people need more living room." That's what it means, Lebensraum. "We need to expand," so he annexed Austria. He took the Sudetenland of Czechoslovakia. Of course, parts of Poland. The whole nation of Poland, actually. So James knew where the tongue would lead. And with the 9th and 10th commandment there, with envy leading the way, we end up in James 4. Verse 1 through 3. So after just reading these verses leading up to this, he goes on to say, "What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires, which become envy? That battle within you, you want something, but you don't get it. You kill and you covet, but you cannot have what you want. You quarrel and fight, and when you ask, you do not receive because you do it with wrong motives. Spend it on your pleasures." It's talking about war, personal war that leads into greater regional and national and international war. So James understood the process that from the tongue could motivate those filled with envy, that want the wealth and stuff of other human beings, will lead to war, and they will take it. And it all started very small, with two kids, or young men, named Cain and Abel. It led to the great WW2, the great one. And just over the horizon is WW3, the really big one. And the next to the last one. We think of it as the last one, but there is one at the end of the millennium, unfortunately. You might say WW3B. So Satan, the great adversary, the father of lies, we saw in Isaiah 14 and 28, who will entice and lead all mankind to the precipice of annihilation, as we see in the book of Revelation. So first, he uses liberalism to weaken through lying, politics, and envy to produce chaos. And then comes the totalitarian tyrants to save society and become, because as you read through Revelation and you read Daniel, you see that this being who will become the most powerful human being in the history of mankind, I don't include Christ, this being we call the beast, the king of the north, will then step onto the stage as a hero. After all the chaos has been created by the liberalism that Satan has engendered through envy of the liberal mind. It's quite a chess match, isn't it, that's going on down here. A lot of strategy and moves being made decades and decades apart. And prototypes being set up. And God is allowing it all on this stage of life. This is planet old Terra Firma. And we have a ringside seat because we have the play. And we know the acts, the actors, what motivates them, and what it's going to look like when the last act of this age takes place. Je suis Charlie. Maybe the catalyst. By the way, you know where that came from, more than likely? You may have seen the movie Spartacus. When Kirk Douglas stepped out, and the Romans were after him, and pretty soon all his, you know, they were freedom fighters. And they all started stepping out. I am Spartacus. They tried to pin him down, and pretty soon they're all saying, I am Spartacus. I am Charlie. I'm not saying it's the right use. I don't condone Charlie, you know, Hebdo, but anyway, get the idea. See the link. So the green-eyed monster in our own personal lives were all led back to one inescapable conclusion about envy, and that is that God, who designed and created us, absolutely knows. He knows how to make us happy and fulfilled and satisfied. And he's the only one. And we need not envy. It does not satisfy. It can and often does lead to war. Personal wars, as well as in all other levels of life. In other words, combining or combating envy, the green-eyed monster, is a matter of believing and faith. Faith in Him who designed and created us and has sent an owner's manual, a designer's manual, that tells us how it all fits together, how it all works, how these complex, made in the image and likeness of God, models that He rolls off the assembly line to the tune of several million a year, most of whom will be around for the rest of eternity. He tells us how they function, how we function, and how they can operate properly, be satisfied and fulfilled. He knows what He's doing. Three simple scriptures I leave you. Sum it all up. There are a lot of others, but I picked these three. How to beat the green-eyed monster, the old gem. They make for excellent prayer and meditation review every day. Good old Proverbs 3, 5 through 6. Trust the Lord in all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. Acknowledge Him in all your ways, and He will guide your paths. Especially the path to Matthew 5:48, the central scripture of the Bible. Become you perfect, spiritually mature as your Father is in heaven. That's the path. And He will do it. Matthew 6:33, if you seek that path, He will provide all that you need for your earthly journey along that path. All. Not some, not most, all. And then finally, Romans 8:28, all things, the spiritual insurance policy for your trip. This is beyond AAA. This is infinite A. All things work for the good of those who love God and are called according to His purpose. Romans 8:28. And when you have hit a pothole on the path to Godhood, on that journey, rest assured that He has allowed it, and it is for your Matthew 8:5-48 good. You will learn something from it. You have to change a tire now and then. Or a spark plug or something. Put gas in the tank. Put air in the tire. Paul may have recorded it best. 2 Corinthians 12:9. Jot it down. After dealing with one of these many spiritual potholes, and Paul had many, just read 2 Corinthians 11. Paul had more potholes. He maybe didn't have one as bad as Job, but when you get killed 3 times and get thrown out of town, you're in shipwreck, get bitten by snakes, you know, beaten, you know, 40 save one, and on it goes. You just can hardly comprehend it. After dealing with one of these many spiritual potholes, God tells him, "My grace is sufficient. It's all you need." And that was enough for Paul. "For only I truly know what you really need. All of us. Everybody in the family. I'm your dad. I know you better than anybody. I made you." And as Cosby used to say when he was popular, "I can make another one." Just like you. But he has. He's made us. And he knows what our needs are, both short and long term, to slay the green-eyed monster and provide the Matthew 5:48 happiness and satisfaction, both now and for the rest of eternity. Why? Because indeed, Father knows best.